This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. More than 5 years into the war in Afghanistan, U.S. military leaders uncovered a serious security gap. Male soldiers didn't have access to a significant portion of the Afghan population, namely women. To remedy this, the U.S. Special Ops recruited women throughout the U.S. to serve in cultural support teams. The teams were put in the battlefield along with Army Rangers, Green Berets, and Navy SEALs, and they served in some of the most sensitive missions in the country. My guest today documented the little-known story of these women in her book, Ashley's War, the untold story of a team of women soldiers on the Special Ops battlefield. It's a behind-the-scenes account of women who served on the front lines of combat years before the combat ban was lifted in 2013. Gail Zamok-Lamon is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a writer and a reporter, and she joins us now. Welcome, Gail.
Well, thank you so much. Great to join you.
You know, this is a little-known story, like a secret, a fairly well-kept secret, at least within the military for a while, women in combat before it was permitted. Tell us how you found out about it and how you got started researching this topic.
Yes, a former Marine was telling me about First Lieutenant Ashley White and this incredible group of women alongside whom she had served on special operations missions in Afghanistan. And this was 2012. And I'd covered Afghanistan for a while and had written my first book, actually, in Afghanistan. So I'd gone back and forth from the U.S. to Afghanistan, thought I knew a decent amount about the war. And I said, well, wait a minute. What do you mean that women were on nighttime operations? Isn't the combat ban on? And a lot of these women in uniform just started laughing and said, you know, Gail, that combat ban long ago ceased to really reflect the reality of what was going on in the battlefield. And so that was the initial spark that led to a whole series of questions that became a book about this incredible team of women who answered America's call to serve and started as teammates, became friends, and really ended as family, and the likes of which we've never seen as a country.
Yeah, it's quite a story. You spoke first with the family of First Lieutenant Ashley White. Tell us a little bit about them and what they wanted to share with you about their daughter.
You know, First Lieutenant Ashley White, I think, is one of the best reflections of American values, of people I've ever reported on. Just an incredible young woman who could have done anything, right? ROTC, Kent State, married her ROTC sweetheart. They lived there in North Carolina and just had this beautiful, really supportive marriage. She was somebody who, you know, was somebody joked to me, was half Martha Stewart and half G.I. Jane, right? Loved to cook dinner for her husband and was incredible at putting, you know, 45 pounds of weight on her back and marching for 10 or 11 miles. And she has this beautiful family that really taught her to always take the hard right over the easy wrong and to do the right thing, to never look for credit, to not do things for celebrity or for attention, but to do them because they were the right thing to do. And they simply wanted, when I called them and said, I really want to know more about your daughter and what she was doing with special operations on the battlefield in Afghanistan in 2011, they said, you know, we were always waiting for someone to call because they did understand that she had been part of history and they did not want her to get credit, but they also wanted to make sure she was never forgotten. And they wanted America to know this incredible band of sisters of whom their daughter was a part.
And I think we can infer from what you're saying, but we should make it explicit that she had been killed in combat. And so
that's right. So that's right.
Go ahead.
In October of 2011, they were on, you know, these women were on nighttime operations alongside Ranger Regiment, alongside the Army Rangers, seeing the kind of combat experienced by less than 5% of the entire United States military. And it's war. And one night they went out and they did not come back.
Tell us about this need that the military found in Afghanistan and the reason these women were recruited. It wasn't just more combat forces they needed. They needed women in particular and particular kinds of women.
That's right. They were seen as what was called a force multiplier, right? So Admiral Olson, who spoke with me, was the first Navy SEAL to lead Special Operations Command. And he and Admiral McCraven both saw this need, who was then running Joint Special Operations Command, saw this need, this security gap out there, because no matter how good they were at combat, male soldiers could not speak to Afghan women, half the population, without causing real cultural offense. And so in the heat of these nighttime operations, which were incredibly sensitive and very unpredictable in terms of how hot and how bad they could turn quickly, you would miss all this information, everything women knew, everything women saw and understood about their homes and their communities was going unseen and unknown. And so their idea was that we need women soldiers who can keep up. They are not Rangers. They were not SEALs, right? They were not doing the same work in terms of assault teams and that nature of combat. But they were out there every single night getting on and off the helicopter, going on to these operations and talking to women, figuring out what they knew, making sure that their quarters didn't have weapons and such. And pretty quickly, these women were able to prove themselves because they did find things, and they did help find the people that the Rangers were looking for on these missions designed to keep the pressure on the insurgency.
That ability to communicate and connect with other women and women across cultures puts an added burden, it seems to me, on the recruiters. What was the recruiting like?
Well, you know, the thing was, it was actually an incredibly easy recruiting process because you had this, and really, I think this is the ultimate story of female friendship in the least likely of places, right, on the special operations battlefield. And, you know, what you had was this whole group of women who answered the call to serve in the exact same way men do, right? What they wanted was to do something that mattered to their country alongside the best of the best, and to test every limit they had in service to America. And so you had gals like a woman like Amber, who was a former intel officer who had helped the FBI bust drug gangs in Pennsylvania. And as soon as she saw this recruiting poster that said, female soldiers, become part of history, join special operations, you know, in Afghanistan, she immediately answered the call. You know, there were Tristan, who is an West Point track star. You know, there was also a gal, Lane Mason, who was an Iraq War veteran who had wanted to do something that mattered. And you had this real band of all-stars who became family at the tip of the spear.
Talk about the training. I think that's some fairly interesting stuff, the kind of training these women went through.
That's right. And in fact, they came to Fort Bragg for what was called 100 hours of hell for selection process, right? So they, about half of them are chosen from the group of women who are brought to Fort Bragg. And then they spend, so they're recruited in March or in May and selected in March or in May, trained in June and July there at Fort Bragg on things from, you know, weapons to cultural training to language skills. And then by August, they're seeing the kind of combat that less than 5% of the military see.
Well, and you're right in your book, and I, you know, you made the point of the book, and again now, that recruiting from the point of view of the women was easy. They wanted to serve. But I'm also talking about the screening process, because as you point out in the book, you needed women who were fit, who could keep up and be part of these special operations, but who also were incredibly feminine. Tell us more about that.
That's right. That's right. I mean, they were women who would be, who had to be elite soldiers, right? Who had to be able to prove themselves night in, night out, alongside the best of the best, alongside men who had been continuously deployed since 9/11. And they had to be out there able to physically be able to put that kind of weight on their back, march for miles in the dead of night with night vision, do their work, be able to, you know, keep up. And if things got very hot or things got very dangerous, which was nearly inevitable, they had to make sure that they were the people who were never the laggards, right, who were not making anybody slower than they otherwise would have been. So they were in the gym three times a day trying to make sure that they were as fit and as fierce as possible. But they also had to be incredibly feminine, because they had to be able to show in the heat of these operations, they had to be able to take off their helmets and say, you know, I'm a woman, I'm a female soldier, and here's why I'm here. And, you know, Amber would wear these sort of combat braids, as she would call them, so that she could quickly take off her helmet and show that she was a woman. And the Rangers alongside whom she served would say, oh, my God, I'd never take off my helmet, but I understand that's part of your job. And that's what they were doing. And the selection process was really designed to find these women who were fierce, fit, and incredibly feminine all at the same time. And that is obviously, you know, a testament, I think, to the women in these pages, that they really could not sign up fast enough to be part of this. And only half of the people who were even brought to Fort Bragg got chosen.
You talked about also the incredible, they're very willing and eager to do this, but then the anxiety builds in, will we fit in? This is a tough group of guys who've been guys, and they've been fighting for a long, long time. They have been a team. They've seen it all, and just the camaraderie that they had built up made it intimidating for these women to join in. Tell us about that, and also the surprise for them, how they overcame some of that.
Yes, and they were worried, right? I mean, to imagine these were men who'd been deployed. Some of these men are on their 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th deployment. in the post 9/11 wars. They had seen a lot of combat, they had seen a lot of fighting, and they had never been out on nighttime operations with women. And they may have had some intel folks, and there certainly were women in civil affairs, but on these kinds of operations, you know, these men had not been asked to take women on their helicopters and to give them one of the precious seats on their helicopters on these operations. And so, of course, there was initial skepticism, right? This whole group of people who you didn't train, didn't recruit on a completely different training cycle. And by the way, they're women. You know, so if there was definitely skepticism. But what they found pretty quickly was 10 years into the war, all anyone wanted was solutions or people who could contribute to the mission and could help accomplish that night's mission. So when you had someone like Tristan, you know, this West Pointer, who finds out in the course of a conversation that there are IEDs and placed all along the path between where they are and where they're headed. Or a gal like a woman like Kimberly, who was with a group of SEALs, and she finds the intel item they're looking for in a baby's diaper one of her first nights out. And so I think very quickly, the fact that they could keep up and that they could deliver while they were on these missions helped them to fit in. And, you know, the men would then take them to the gym and take them to, you know, they would talk with them in the gym and they would see them when they were doing target practice. And so I think that there was a community that was built up. It's not that it was all easy and perfect, but they proved themselves on the battlefield, which is what allowed them to be accepted as part of the team.
Yeah, and to give us a picture of some of the other missions and some of the things they were doing, I think there's another example when the team learned that they were not going to get air support that night because of bad weather. And again, one of the women proved herself.
Yes, and I mean, you know, another one of these nights that they weren't going to, there was one of Ashley's roommates. Ashley's an artillery officer, and she has always been wanting to show that she knew her job, right? And she ends up giving them the support they need from back at the base, and proves that, you know, all that time she had spent listening to them and understanding what they needed on these missions was not in vain, that she could actually really contribute. And it's that ability to contribute, to show what you did and to make it very quickly apparent that you bring value, that allowed this group of women, this band of sisters, to show that they were there for the exact same reason these men were, just to do something meaningful that mattered to America. And I think you do see that. And in Ashley's passing, you know, these Rangers sent a beautiful note to Ashley's family and weapons squad leaders. So, you know, what Ashley was doing was not easy, but these women were out there proving themselves.
You spend some time also highlighting the perspective of a woman named Nadia, who served as Ashley's interpreter.
Yes.
On the ground. Tell us more about her.
Yeah, so, you know, Nadia was a woman from Orange County, California, who thought she was going to, you know, her family were Afghan refugees. They had worked very hard to get out of Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion. And then all of a sudden, here's Nadia in her 20s, beautiful young woman, great person, and wants to do humanitarian missions. So she signs up to become a translator and actually ends up pretty quickly, 36 hours after she lands in Afghanistan, realizes she's going to be translating for Bagram detainees, high-value detainees, not the humanitarian mission she had expected. And so she's interpreting 12 hours on, 12 hours off. And her family had said, why are you going back when we worked so hard to get out? And her answer was, I want to do something meaningful. And America needs these language skills right now, because interpreters were really very hard to find, as particularly with very good Pashto skills and very good English skills. And she ends up being recruited to what one male interpreter derisively called, you know, the pink team, which is this group of women, Ashley and her teammates, and she is their eyes and ears out there every single night.
You talked to men, of course, as well, who served alongside, and we got their perspective. And as you said, once the main thing is, do you have my back? That's the thing that counts out.
That's
here.
Right.
And politics and ideology drops pretty quickly. But what were they telling you about the service of these women?
Yeah, and I think they saw that for these women, it was never about proving a point, ever. It was about serving with purpose. And, you know, the gym was the big test ground, right? You know, the fact that Ashley and her teammates would be in there in the gym, this was in Kandahar, you know, more than 2 hours a day, and would be, you know, busting out 25 or 30 pull-ups from a dead hang, climbing ropes using only their arms. And then the fact they were still women, right? So Ashley had a bread maker in her office there in Kandahar and would make, you know, batches of raisin bread and would share those. And so I think for these men, this was something entirely new, but they had also been evolving themselves, particularly Ranger regiments, since 9/11. And so once they saw that these women made a difference, they became more or less, you know, part of their team. And that's what they talked to me about. You know, one Ranger first sergeant said to me, "A job well done sticks out, and I don't care who's doing it."
This obviously was kept pretty much under wraps before the ban was lifted. The ban has since been lifted, and the story is out. Do you think the narrative, these stories, have made their way through the military? Does it counter maybe some common criticisms about women serving in combat?
You know, Ashley's War is my best effort to take readers into a world we've never seen, of friendship cemented by what they saw and did at the tip of the spear while America had no idea they were even there, right? And this incredible friendship and bond that they share forever. And I hope the narrative just illuminates this conversation and really shows not what women could do or should do or are capable of, but it's one story of what they've already done.
What do you think about the decisions that are being made now? I think January 2016, they're up for consideration again, women in combat. Do you have any idea how those decisions might go? And again, will this narrative play a part? Do you think it might shape some of those decisions?
I think these women in Ashley's War already have played a role. You know, in the book's epilogue, there's a moment where one of the major generals from Special Operations Command actually refers to Ashley and her teammates in a June 2013 press conference and says, you know, these women may well have laid the foundation for ultimate integration, talking about what they did out there and how they surprised people by showing what women were capable of. You know, there were some women in the story who, you know, when there were very precious seats on the helicopter, they were given a seat over some other enablers just because what they did was useful and couldn't be replicated as easily. You know, there were other moments in this story where there were people who were very surprised by how much having those women out there could help them accomplish. And so I think, you know, little by little, this is a small slice of history that we have the privilege of witnessing unfold in real time.
Do you know if the stories themselves were making their way out and sort of how widespread they were in the military and whether women in the military were sort of pointing to this where they might have felt some resistance in other areas?
You know, it's interesting. Ashley's War documents a small program, right? I mean, you're talking a couple of hundred women total, where women have been breaking ground in all kinds of other ways. And there were women who came before and were doing these kinds of missions in ones and twos, just not formally, for years because of the battlefield need to have women talking to other women in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And the first chapter of Ashley's War talks about that. So I think that these stories, everything that women have accomplished in the post 9/11 wars has been noted. But I do hope that having all of this in one place just opens people's eyes. And again, this was never about politics for them and not for me either, writing the story. It's simply a great story of a group of Americans we've never met who answered the call to serve. And I do hope it takes what people think they know about women in combat and just puts a little flashlight on a story that we should know about service to America.
Gail, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to join you. I'm a fan of the show. Thank you.
Thank you. Author and journalist Gail Zamok-Lamon. Her new book, Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. You can find out more about the book and see photos of Ashley and her team at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Raleigh's Theater in the Park imagines a mix of art and politics in the time of Shakespeare. Stay with us.